Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
You look so serious.
Yeah. I am serious. I want to get, we got a big podcast to get going here. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining, welcome. And if you're returning, welcome. How's it going? Hope you're having a great day. See what happens every time you subscribe and come back to the Ethics Experts. You get a bonus greeting on every episode. I am here with Sarah Badiman. How you doing, Sarah?
I'm doing good. Nick, how are you?
Great. I'm pretty pumped to get you on here. We met on LinkedIn. I followed you a little bit for a while. I think we have a similar kind of view of the world, a similar kind of impact that we're trying to make. So I was excited to come on and pick your brain a little bit and see how you see the world.
How I see the world. Through rose-colored glasses, Nick.
Me too.
Through
rose-colored glasses. That's all I got. Those are the only glasses I have.
I know, you have to have them, right? Because otherwise, like, my family has always called me Pollyanna, like, and I'm a perpetual Pollyanna. I will always look for the bright side, the rosy side of things.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm kind of the same way. And I just think we live in such a negative world. The negativity is going to take care of itself. You know what I'm saying? If something bad's going on, you'll find out about it. You know what I mean?
Well, It's only your reaction to it too that, you know, that matters, right? All the negative stuff can happen in the world. And if you don't react to it, then it doesn't affect you.
Well, and it's also a question to your point of like, what can we even control?
Well, right.
You know, it's like, it's kind of like getting upset that it's raining. It's like, okay, well, you can't do anything with that. You can't do anything about it. Yeah, all you can do is respond to it, right?
Right. So my grandmother used to say, like, you have to enjoy the rain. Otherwise, you'll never have the rainbow. Is if you complain about the rain, will you ever step outside to see the rainbow? No. But if you sit back and enjoy the rain, then you can also enjoy the rainbow.
I love that quote. All right. Well, if you hear me saying that a lot, just know that
Just know that it was my grandmother Curry.
So how did you get into this game? Tell us a little bit about your company. Tell us about your path in, you know, I'm so interested always in how people got into compliance because no one's like growing up wanting to be a compliance officer or something like that, but we wind up here and, you know, so what's your winding path into this game?
My winding path. Yeah. Cause like everybody, I did not grow up or even go to school thinking, oh man, I really love HIPAA. And I think I want to be a HIPAA, like in the HIPAA game, right? Or even in compliance, right? But growing up, I'm the middle child. And so I've always had this like strong sense of justice and fairness, right? I think that that is a natural state of being for every middle kid. And so I've always been drawn to that type of work. And I've also always really wanted to help others. And so I started off in healthcare through a various degree of compliance positions, right? Or in administrative positions. And then I kind of fell into this idea to start doing my own security risk analyses, like kind of on the side after hours kind of thing, because meaningful use came about. And, you know, I was going around talking to other practices for my day job. And they were like, hey, do you know anything about how to do the security risk analysis? And I was like, you know, it's basically math. I can do that. My background's in mathematics. So started doing these security risk analyses for these practices and small hospitals. And then I got enough of them that I quit my day job and just started doing consulting. Then I had this great idea to start a software company, right? And the first time I tried to start it, it failed so fantastically. When I tell you it failed, I mean, crash and burn, baby. It was a disaster.
Tell us all the horror stories.
Well, it started with just, I didn't have confidence. So when I had the idea for HIPAA compliance software, it really came about because I was at this conference in San Francisco and I was sat at this table with two investors that I didn't even know that they were investors, right? Yeah. I just thought they were two friendly men willing to listen to me talk. And I was complaining about the fact that, you know, nobody has developed a really good compliance software. I looked for everything to solve this need for my clients. And I couldn't find it. It didn't exist. What I was finding was Dropbox for HIPAA or really exorbitantly expensive and complicated software that it didn't need to be that expensive or that clunky and difficult to use. And they told me, why don't you just start it? Well, I had zero confidence in my ability to start a tech company. I know nothing about tech, right? Here I am just the math nerd, right? That's what I thought of myself. Thought of myself as that little geek back from high school that nobody wanted to talk to. And that was, you know, so that's how I saw, like, and so I thought I need to partner with somebody. So I found somebody to partner with, and he talked me into a 50-50 deal. So like split the company 50-50. And what he really meant was he wanted me to do all of the work and him to take all of the money that I worked for out of the company. So I found out he was embezzling.
Yeah, yeah, 50-50. Oh, you didn't know that that's what 50-50 means.
I didn't know that embezzling was part of 50-50.
You got to read the fine print on those kind of deals.
I got to read that fine print, right. Yeah, yeah. So, because I mean, he was spending money at like Men's Warehouse and a Brazilian steakhouse and like, and taking his wife out to dinner on the company dollar that I was doing all the work for. I brought in the money. Yeah. And we didn't even have any software yet. So a year into the business and we still didn't have a software and all my cash is going away, including money I'm investing into the software. I decided I'm out and I left.
So what was his role supposed to be? Was he supposed to be
the CEO? Because I had, again, I had zero confidence in myself. I didn't think I could do it, right? I'm the compliance nerd. I know I was a subject matter expert. I didn't need to run the company. I needed to guide the product and do, and that's where my mind was, like no confidence in myself whatsoever. And then once all this happened, so one of the things too is like, I am a very stubborn person. And so when I decide that I want something, I'm going to work to get it. And so I wanted this HIPAA compliant software, right? I wanted to build something to help other people, right? Yeah. And so when I left that first company that I started with this guy, I started HIPAA Trek 7 days later, I incorporated it. Because I knew if I incorporated, and I didn't have a single client, a single line of code, I had nothing but an idea and determination, right? I was like, but I'm going to get this done. So I went on to codeacademy.com. I taught myself how to code. I am not a coder. Right? My whole background is in mathematics and healthcare. I knew nothing about coding, but I was arrogant enough to think, how hard can it be? Right? Like,
yeah. So I get the joke in calling it arrogant. I think it's probably more rude. Like, you're not an arrogant person, or I mean,
no,
I don't know.
I'm not, but I do overestimate my intelligence a lot. A lot of times I think I'm smarter than I actually am.
But so I'm reading this book that talks a lot about this thing. And I'm so interested in what you're talking about, because you're talking about, man, I didn't have the confidence to do it. And you started doing it and you started getting probably some like positive momentum. And then you had this sort of albatross around your neck, this empty suit. Well, I guess he had some new suits from, you know, men.
Yeah, he had some new suits, yeah.
Yeah, so you had this person, but, you know, perhaps him getting in the mix is what got you at least to start like entertaining this on a more, you know, real level and really sort of forming out this vision. But what took over is your determination. And like entrepreneurs, always successful people, entrepreneurs, whatever, it's so much rooted in like the stories we tell ourselves. And like an optimist and a pessimist see the exact same world, right? We see the same news lines, we see these same things, but it's all about the stories that we tell ourselves. And I'm kind of the same way. That's like my catchphrase, like how tough could that be? And then I get into it and it's like way tougher. But like, if we didn't think that, if we didn't have that initial misconception, whatever, right? We would never step through that door. And then we'd never get so full, you know, halfway baked, you know, so like halfway across the river where it's like, all right, well, I can't turn back now. So it's just interesting how people characterize it, because again, you don't seem like an arrogant person, but you seem like a really determined person.
Very determined.
Interesting how that determination can supersede the lack of confidence we may feel in a moment and still be enough to like catalyze us to take that plunge, you know?
Right. Well, I've always been one too. Like whenever somebody tells me I can't do something, I will do it just to show them that I can.
Interesting.
Like, don't tell me I can't. Again, classic middle child syndrome, right? Like classic. So my dad was a middle kid, and so he showered me with all the attention. So I didn't have all of the feeling invisible part of the syndrome, but I do have a lot of the competitiveness, right? Like that comes with.
Right.
And I also don't know if that's just the way that my parents raised me, because I'll never forget when I was a freshman in high school, I won second place at state and track. And then my dad told me, congratulations, you're the first place loser. And right. I still-
Oh, you never forgot that, huh?
Oh God, no. That was like 21 years ago. I still remember it. It's like, but actually it was a long time, well, much longer ago than that, probably closer to 31 years ago. But I still remember that vividly. So
you're in Code Academy. I'm going to make this happen. How tough could it be? I'm going to jump into Code Academy.
Yeah. So I taught myself how to code, and I coded the first iteration of the software while I was coding this. So I was coding at night, and I was during the day, I was going to all these folks that were my clients for my consulting business and asking them, will you use this? Right. And I had used a software that I could use to kind of create a phantomware, where just with some basic HTML coding, you can create what looks and feels like real software. And so I was going out and showing it to people, like for-
This is what it's gonna look like. This is your prototype. Yeah.
Right, well, I told them that it was like in testing, which was not true. I totally lied, because I was really going home at night and coding and making changes as I needed to with their input.
Got it.
Right. So I would go and talk to the hospital, talk to the clinic. They would tell me what they wanted differently, and I would do it. Well, and then I really, so then my daughter, my oldest daughter, who is now 25, so she's still around, got super sick. She started having problems. So she has a congenital heart defect and ended up needing major open heart surgery. At the same time, I was promising to release this software.
Oh my gosh.
So, but still determined, and I still made a commitment to these clinics and to one hospital. And so I told them that it was going to be released on this day. But my daughter, who was 18 at the time, was in the middle of a life-changing surgery.
Wow.
And to distract myself, I continue to code from the parents' lobby, because I never left the hospital. I never left. Like, on a very disgusting note, I think I went like 10 days without a shower because they didn't have a place for parents to shower.
Yeah.
And you're not allowed to use the shower in your kid's room. So, and the one time, like once I knew my daughter was stable, like I wanted to leave, I got called right back. I made it to the parking garage and I got called back to the hospital. But that's neither. You can cut that piece out.
No, we have to do it all. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, so I get ready, I do the final testing, and I think, okay, this is ready for release. And I release the software into the wild to this handful of folks that had prepaid me, by the way, for access to the software.
Okay.
And it failed again so fantastically, but at least this time I had software. The first time that company failed, no software.
Right.
So HipaTrack's still around, so we didn't fail, but that first iteration of the software failed. And again, like it failed beautifully, right? Like in just like the most beautiful explosion you can imagine. And then
so what do you mean by that? It failed
beautifully. Because everybody could see everybody's data, right? So if Dr. A was in the software messing around with it, Dr. B could see and then change. So, because what I had learned was I learned how to code, but I didn't learn anything about databases. I didn't learn how to set everything up. I didn't learn anything about architecture. So I built out a piece of software without any foundation.
Got it.
So it crumbled, right? But I learned that people would buy the software, people would use the software. And so those were two important lessons for me to know, because that made it to where I would continue going. So one doctor, Dr. Sanjay Bhatt, who's actually here in St. Louis, called me and said, Sarah, you have a really good idea, but it is executed poorly. He actually met me in the hospital, like to talk to me about the idea. And then he told me he wanted to introduce me to who is now my co-founder and business partner, Ed Camp, because he was the tech guy. And so essentially Ed, you know, hired a team of developers, came in and started like actually using professional coders to code it. I have since been locked out of the active code. I have read-only access because I would continue to go in. I thought I was helping, you know, fix bugs and things, but apparently I was just breaking other stuff. So
yeah, you knew enough to be dangerous, it sounds like.
Yeah. So, but that's how we got started. And it just kept going from there, you know, and we kept growing and we kept, I mean, it's hard to get a software company up and going. It's really hard, you know, especially like, and I hate to say, especially as a woman, but especially as a woman and especially in the Midwest, these are difficult things to overcome. Because I will never forget, so I don't know what the rating of your podcast is, but I'm going to say something. Okay.
Extremely high. Yeah, the highest, I think.
Okay, cool. I'm kidding. Okay. Okay, well, you can bleep me.
But oh, rating. I get it. Yeah, this is a, it's kind of a, you know, it's fine. It's just adult.
Is it PG-13? Okay.
It's a PG-13, but you also get one F-bomb per.
Okay. Well, it's not an F-bomb.
Okay.
So, but I had, so we were, I'd grown, I had approximately 40, 50 clients. I was really moving forward and I was looking to start to raise some money because I had already put in about $200,000 of my own cash, like my cash, not sweat equity, my cash into the business. And so I was like, you know, like I need some help with this because like, you know, I'm fairly young. Like at that point I was, you know, I wasn't even 40 yet. And so I was like, I need some cash to help me get going.
You got to accelerate it. You know, you can't do it all on your own, you know?
And I approached an investor here in St. Louis that I'd heard about, you know, and everybody in St. Louis knows him. Mm-hmm. And you know what he told me? He told me if I hired a quote, big swinging dick, that he would invest in us because he liked the idea. So he liked the idea of what we were doing, but because I'm a girl, because I'm a woman, I'm not capable of running my company.
How did that feel?
Oh, it felt really bad, especially because then when I told somebody else who had already invested in my company what had happened, he was like, yeah, you need a gray hair. If you had a gray hair, meaning an old man, you know, then you can accelerate things faster. That's what you need. That's what you need. And so all these things made me dig my heels in, right? Because again, back to the very beginning, I'm extremely stubborn. So I will dig my heels in and I will say, no, I am here to stay.
Right.
And I've made HipAttract all about the product and our clients. So nobody even cares that I'm a woman. Because when you look at compliance, it's a female dominated industry.
Got it.
Because I am not the only one that got into compliance because I felt like I have this sense of fairness and justice and needing to make sure that the world is right.
Because and you've experienced the world as not right and you've experienced the world as not fair at some level.
Right, right. Even if it's just in my messed up middle kid brain, right. Okay. Yeah, I mean, and so like, I've just dug my heels in and that's what I've done. And we've gotten traction and we've gotten clients because of the way we treat our clients, right? I think back to when I sat in their shoes and I felt like I did not have the resources. I did not have the help and that compliance was utilized as a bolt-on piece of the enterprise versus an integral part of the business. And when you have this bolt-on mentality about compliance, we don't become a valuable business asset. And so my whole goal is to make sure my clients, because most of the time I'm dealing with the compliance folks, you know, I want them to feel valued, respected, and like they have all the resources. So yes, we provide software, but more than that, the level of service that we provide our clients is beyond what they would get anywhere else. And that is truly our differentiator because we are the only software that was created by somebody who sat in their shoes, who sat there and did what they did on a day in and day out basis and knew exactly. So I know, I don't have to guess or empathize with how they feel. I know exactly how they feel. Right. I know exactly what they're going through. I know exactly what the struggles are. I don't have to read about what struggles compliance officers have. I don't have to call them up and ask them what struggles they have. I already know.
You lived it.
I lived it. And so, and our clients all know and respect that, right? So they like, we and don't do consulting. We don't have a consulting line to our business. We are solely software, right. But a lot of our clients will use us in a consultative like basis, and we accept it. We don't charge for that. Like, call us, ask us any questions you want. You need help, call, we'll help.
Right.
You know, I have to stay up until midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning working on your issue. I have no problem doing that. Call right. me. I'll help you.
And it's yes, real, and they can feel it.
Yeah. So, which is another thing we can say, in the almost 7 years since we were founded, you know, and 4 years of actually having software, you know, 4.5 years of actually having software, we've only lost 4 clients.
Wow.
And I can tell you each client and why they left. And nobody left because our software wasn't good enough.
Well, that's a good...
nobody left because of... You know? Yeah, and nobody left because of who we were. Right. They were either acquired or they ran out of money.
So, I mean, you know, that's just what it's going to take. It's going to take this kind of an approach for these bolt-on functions to turn into the strategic thing that I think they can and should be inside of an organization.
Well, right. Well, I mean, and I see so many people like, so I just was speaking with Kyle Fromm, who's the compliance officer for Advent up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was actually on my podcast. And he was talking about how compliance needs to be viewed as the revenue sustainer.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And not because so many times, like, organizations look at compliance, like, so even like you, like with Compliance Line and me with HIPAATrack, you know, like they view us as just a line on the budget. And they think that we are just taking up money, right? Because we don't generate revenue. So that's what they view us as. Right. Well, Kyle says that without, and I loved this quote from Kyle, the fact that compliance is a revenue sustainer, because without us, without compliance, they will have massive fines. They can lose access to their records, right? So if they don't take security seriously, they lose access to their records. If they don't work through patient complaints and patient requests, then they will have fines. The OCR has now issued 10 settlements based off of access to record requests that were ignored by covered entities. So, I mean, without us, that's what's happening. And I can guarantee you in the upcoming political environment that we're entering into, those OCR audits are going to start back up. So everything we've seen in the past, like in the past 4 years, is going to be amplified, because those OCR audits that were paused 3 years ago are going to come back.
So, I love that frame of kind of a revenue sustainer.
Yeah, Kyle's brilliant.
Yeah, he sounds brilliant. So the revenue sustainer, that's absolutely right. But there's kind of a spectrum of this, right? Like on one end, you have a cost center, which is just, you know, stinks. I have to have it. It adds no value other than the box that I'm checking. Sort of the next layer, you know, kind of as we move towards the positive of what the true dimensionality of this function is and should be, we can talk about, well, like fine minimization, that's revenue, you know, that's sort of like, that's cost reduction at some level. It's revenue sustainment at some level if we're able to minimize complaints from patients and do those things right, absolutely. And then I think there's even like another step to it that we can continue to push toward and ascend toward on a lot of the upside and a lot of the positive externalities that can come from a really strong compliance function in the way that it ends up influencing behavior sort of culturally within the organization.
Right. And I think that's actually a really good point, because at the very bottom line of it, compliance is quality patient care.
Correct.
And organizations need to stop looking at compliance as anything but patient care. We are more patient care than most of your other administrators, certainly more than finance, certainly more than anything. Like, we are more towards sustaining patient care, because let's just forget about all the privacy aspect of HIPAA, which is probably in a patient's mind the most important part of HIPAA. But if we look at it just from a security point, we have all these ransomware, not just threats, but actual attacks that are happening.
They're actually happening.
In Germany, we had a patient that died because of a ransomware attack. She died in transit, tragic. So now we know patient loss can happen as a direct result of a cybersecurity event. Then when, like, two or three weeks ago in late October, the University of Vermont was hit by a ransomware attack, and it caused days worth of delays in cancer treatments and other critical treatments. Wow. So although no loss of life has been established yet, you can guarantee if this trend continues, we're going to see massive loss of life. And these malicious actors don't care. They do not care at all about where we stand and the fact that we're trying to treat patients. They're actually taking advantage of that. And they're taking advantage of the fact that we don't see compliance and cybersecurity as a integral part of our business line, as an integral part to patient care. And they're taking advantage of that. The entire health industry needs to pull their heads up out of the sand and take a good hard look at exactly what's going to happen if they're not compliant. This has nothing to do with regulations. This has nothing to do with politics. This has nothing to do with anything, right? Because so many times I go into hospitals and talk to the C-suite and they're like, oh, well, this is just a political thing to do this. I hate HIPAA. And so therefore they don't like me.
Really?
It's like, whatever, you know, like I'm just here to help you with your patients. Yeah, it happens a lot.
You think HIPAA is a political thing?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Tell me some more about that. I don't get that.
Well, because it's a government regulation. And so hospitals that have C-suite that are filled with physicians, which can happen, especially in rural health and short-term acute hospitals. So they're smaller hospitals. So they tend to think that HIPAA is just the government and that it's a checkbox mentality. And they, because they are physicians and not business people, they do not understand the correlation between compliance and patient quality, like quality patient care.
That's an interesting dynamic, yeah. I'm just kind of like spiraling out into like the implications of what that dynamic translates into. And it's obviously the tide that you're kind of swimming against all the time, but it's such a backward, to your point, mentality, you know?
Right. Well, and we always tell people that compliance, number one, is not a checkbox. It's a journey, which is why we're HIPAA Trek, right? Because Trek is a long journey. And so it is a journey. It is not a destination. It is not a checkbox. You need a clear roadmap, which is your strategy, in order to be able to deliver on it. You need to know what your goals are and the reasons for your goals. And if your reason for your goal is not to deliver quality patient care and to protect your ability to provide that care, then you should just resign your job right now and let somebody come in that cares.
Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, like what's the point then? If you're just gonna do a check the box thing and you don't understand that there's any like true implications for it and you don't actually care, then you're never gonna get any of the positive externalities of this, you know, whatever you called it, a revenue sustainer or, you know, profit maximizer or whatever, you know, whatever these sort of, you know, higher sort of actualizations of this function can and should be. You'll never touch it.
You'll never get, right. So, because when we look at HIPAA, there are three things that we should be considering when we're trying to protect our data, both electronic and other mediums, right? That's the confidentiality, integrity, and availability.
Okay.
Right? And in healthcare, so in cybersecurity, that's called the CIA triangle. Mm-hmm. And in healthcare, the A, availability, is the most important point on that triangle.
Why?
Because if you don't have availability to the records, you can't treat. Patients are poor historians of their own health. I mean, they don't know what surgeries they've had. They don't know what diagnoses they have. They don't know what medications they are on. And they don't communicate that well to their family members. And so without availability to records, you can actually kill a patient. Imagine if you have somebody who's diabetic come in and they don't tell you that they're diabetic. You don't know that they're diabetic, you know, because, and then you give them saline.
Right.
You've just killed that patient.
Right. Yeah. So that availability is critical because lives are on the line.
Lives are on the line. Right. Protecting the confidentiality, that is also incredibly important in healthcare. Protecting the integrity is more important than the confidentiality, because if a hacker comes in, breaks into your system and changes the records, or a malicious employee, so an employee, and this actually has happened where angry employees that aren't their access to the EMR isn't terminated, they go in and they change records. Like that has happened and it will continue to happen, right? So protecting the integrity of the data is also important, because if they go in and change that information, again, lives are on the line.
Right.
This is not just the government trying to collect money from hospitals and clinics. This is not just giving jobs to people like Nick and Sarah. This is actual quality patient care.
Yeah, it's bizarre that, it's bizarre that it's 2020 and we're still having this kind of discussion, that people don't see the connection between sort of compliance and patient care. We see it in, like, you see it in food safety and food quality. I mean, it's a similar sort of an analogy, like.
Right, but how long did it take for us to get to that point? A long time.
I know, it's just not fast enough, so. I'm not happy with the pace. I wanted to go a little bit quicker, but to your point, it is a journey, and it is a long.
We have come a long way. Road. Yeah, I mean, because compliance in healthcare, in particular, is still a very new industry.
Right.
We are essentially the pioneers. We are pioneering what this is going to look like for future generations.
Right.
And we better leave them a good trail.
So I love your analogy and your picture of this being a trek. And I do kind of agree that it's like, you know, it's kind of journey over destination kind of and everything in life. And I think there's an interesting kind of analogy between like culture and compliance. I on a separate level, I think kind of compliance feeds into culture and that's a whole different flywheel. But what we're talking about at some level is saying, hey, I'm going to start a company and, you know, I need to have a mission and vision and values page. So I'm going to fill those things out. And those are just going to sit and sort of essentially gather dust in the sort of internet ether. If that is not an ongoing process within your company of continual refinement and breathing life into those values and taking those, as we say, taking those values up off the wall and actually living them out, if you're not engaging on this sort of culture journey, then you're never going to get any of the cultural benefits that come along with a strong culture, which to me is kind of the only sustainable competitive advantage that exists in business, because you can't replicate it. It's organic. It comes from a heart and so forth. I'm just saying the same thing happens on the compliance side. If you think it's just, hey, I need a compliance, you know, person and let's get something and we'll just sort of put something on the wall, you're never going to get any of those benefits that can translate into better patient care, less lawsuits, more revenue preservation. You know, now sort of the added dimension of cultural, you know, benefits and sort of behavioral changes that are more in line with the pursuit of the organization's mission. You never get to realize those things. You try to like impose them by edict as opposed to putting the sort of, you know, the guardrails up that that the train can just sort of run on, you know?
Right. And I think too, like Nick, if you really look at it and you look at what the leadership at a hospital or clinic or whatever, like organization, what they care about, it's going to touch compliance. Compliance is going to touch on that. No matter what it is you care about.
Through the entire organization, to your point.
Right. So compliance is the vascular system to any organization. Yes. Yep. We are the vascular system. So, because we go everywhere and we deliver those vital red blood cells, white blood cells, T blood cells, like we're delivering everything.
It's a really important and critical connection to make, I think. So who is it on? It's on all of us, I get it. But like, who is it on to turn those light bulbs on at the top? How can we how can we accelerate this, the adoption of this frame that you and I are, that clearly resonates with me? Like whatever you're talking about is clearly resonating with me. How do we get more people to see like, oh my gosh, dude, I've been looking at this totally backwards all this time. I need to empower these people. I need to unleash them because they're really going to help us accelerate and achieve our organizational purpose more readily.
Right. So right now, compliance is a battle, right? Because it's compliance officers are not high up on the food chain. A lot of times in hospitals, they're the director of HIM, they're the director of IT or the CIOs. In larger health systems, they're luckier and the compliance department does have a seat on senior leadership, which is good. But if you don't have compliance coming down from the very top, and I mean coming from the board level, you have to have compliance discussed at every single board meeting, because compliance is driving everything your hospital is doing. Because even if you look at what the DOJ is bringing out with billing compliance lately, right? So it's not just privacy and security with HIPAA, also all of your billing compliance, right? So, which does directly affect your revenue. And so if you aren't having these compliance discussions on availability, integrity, confidentiality, billing, like integrity, like everything with compliance, like at the board level and the board pushing that down, you're going to constantly have a fight, because water flows down much easier than it flows up. And so when you're trying to get an organizational change, it has to come from the top. It has to come from the leadership, right? The good thing about hospital boards is those board members have limits on how long they can serve. And so you, if you have a board member who is not on board with your compliance objectives, because again, compliance is the vascular system of your entire organization, then you can replace that board member and how, whatever your board terms are, right? Because they will poison your whole organization. It has to come from the top down, because if the board is pushing and the board is serious about compliance, so will the CEO. If the CEO is serious about compliance, so will the COO and all the director level people. While the director level people are serious about compliance, then so will all the people at the bottom of the chain. So when people are saying that compliance is everybody's responsibility, that's true. But that's also a scapegoat, because it then takes all, it shifts all of the responsibility and leadership off of leadership.
That, you know, while it's, you know, the sentiment behind it, I get, it ends up kind of turning into a platitude. And if everyone's responsible, nobody is. And there's an interesting corollary, I think, with like manufacturing, like the best manufacturing companies, they talk about safety at every single board meeting. What's our safety report? What's our OSHA? You know, all that, you know, how many lost time incidents are there? All those things are on board in every single, or are on the agenda for every board meeting. To your point, many times they're kicked off talking about that stuff. And so, you know, maybe it's just the natural thing. Like it just takes a long time. Like, you know, that best practice obviously wasn't in place during the Gilded Age or during the Industrial Revolution, right? That's a bunch of regulation and sort of compliance stuff came up out of all the havoc that was coming from that sort of just raw pursuit of like production and all that stuff. It took a long time to get to the point where these sort of pillars of safety and so forth, and these sort of best practices have, you know, been latched onto and implemented in organizations. So, you know, maybe I'm just kind of speaking to my, the impatience that I was alluding to before, because to your point, we are kind of still pioneering this thing. We don't know what it's all going to look like. It's not like there's a broad acceptance to say like, okay, compliance is not a cost center. This is something that we need, and we need to like energize and actualize and animate, you know?
Oh, right. And provide all the resources necessary, right?
Exactly.
So
exactly.
If you are a small hospital, right? So we work primarily with critical access hospitals, or like that's primarily our base, and short-term acute. So most of our hospitals have fewer than 500 beds. So tiny hospitals. Well, when we go into those hospitals and the compliance person that we're dealing with is also the HIM director, do you really think that that poor HIM director has time to do both jobs and do them both effectively?
No.
What we find even more concerning is when we go in, and it, as has been the case in several places, the CEO is actually responsible for HIPAA compliance. And you're like, are you serious? How can you be?
Yeah, how do you have time for it? Like, to your point, it's a job in and of itself.
It's a title. They're saying, well, this person's responsible for HIPAA, which means nobody's getting the job done.
Right.
Because, like, I know HIPAA does not require you to have a dedicated privacy and security officer, right? So like that's their only job. But when you think about all of the different compliance inside of your hospital, why wouldn't you want that? When you look
right.
You can hire a compliance generalist, one that can be responsible for OSHA, billing, HIPAA, you know, whatever your state regulations are, like your JCO, your joint commission now, they're not called JCO anymore. I keep forgetting, it shows my age. You know, your joint commission, like anything that you have for governance, risk, and compliance, you can have one person be responsible for all of that, right? And they're not responsible for doing, they're responsible for overseeing,
right?
So they're responsible for going to the billing, like the director of billing, and saying, okay, let me do a code review with you. Like, let's check in, make sure. Like this is going to the IT department and saying, this is what we need to do. You know, that should be their responsibility, you know, right. And you don't need somebody with all these. So everybody looks for the alphabet soup and like candidate when they're looking for a compliance candidate, you know, like you don't need the alphabet soup. What you need is somebody who is detail focused. If they can't see like every single thing and they're not focused on the details and extremely highly organized, then they're not the right candidate for you, regardless of what their alphabet soup behind their name says.
Right. It's a great point. But I think when there's not a deep understanding of what's needed, when it's just kind of this kind of opaque black box of, okay, it's just kind of compliance, then it's easy to like fall back on that heuristic of like, oh, I just need somebody with a bunch of sort of, you know, alphabet soups behind their name without thinking about, well, like what's the nuance of like what the personality type needs or to be successful in the job or like, you know what I'm saying?
Right. I mean, don't get me wrong. I have some alphabet soup behind my name too, but like it's, I did it because the industry valued it, not because I valued it.
Interesting.
Do I really think that it makes me more of an expert because I can pass a test? No, like, because I also have to pay to do continuing education at the pay. It's like the alphabet soup behind your name is an industry in and of itself.
Correct.
Especially right now in compliance, because it is such a new field, right? It is new, it is evolving. I think eventually it will mean something, but like, cause I think that we'll be able to get a license that is like state recognized, like the CPA, right? Or the JD or the, you know, I think that that's when those.
I think that's what it'll head toward, or that's what we'll hopefully be heading towards.
I kind of see it that way because I see a lot of, so compliance again, like has such a responsibility within the organization, right? Again, we are like bringing the blood around the organization.
Oh, yeah,
so, yeah. And so much like how like the CPAs have that high level of responsibility around your money and you need that certification, I do see that as coming down the way and needing that type of state recognized or government recognized
credential,
right? To say this person really is who they say they are, right?
Yeah, and I think the field itself, like, you know, lends itself to what you're talking about because there's sort of a principle-based approach to it. At some level, right? There's a standardization at some level. It's testable and sort of falsifiable, you know, so to speak. Whereas, you know.
Yeah, I was like, and we're doing audits. We have access to incredibly sensitive information. Like, I do think that we do need to evolve into having something like that. But again, we're very new, right? So it will happen. But I think that this compliance journey that the US is on establishing this compliance in healthcare is definitely a fun roller coaster. So yeah,
it is fun. I mean, to your point, we're I just love that picture of we're like explorers or we're, you know, we're the pioneers, you know, we're at the frontier of this thing. And it is an exciting time to be in the industry. And there's just so much opportunity for this little acorn that's starting to sprout to turn into this massive oak tree that can really provide a lot of shade and a lot of, you know, benefits to the organizations that we're all a part of.
Oh, I would agree. So I think one of the things, cause I'm from Virginia originally, right? So I grew up there in the mountains there. So you know, we call it Appalachia, not Appalachia, like the rest of the world.
You say it properly, right?
I do say it properly, right? So we are kind of like where those first pioneers were, right? So like right in the, like we're just starting to get over the first layer of the Blue Hills of the Appalachia. That's where we are. We haven't made it even into Tennessee yet.
Yeah.
We're still right there trying to blaze that trail.
Yeah. What does the Mississippi represent? We're going to dive deep into this analogy.
Oh, into the, so what
maybe is that's the certifications. I don't know.
Maybe, Cross- yeah. Yeah, maybe the Mississippi does represent that because that's when we'll get to the gold rush.
You're right. Ooh, what a time to be alive.
I know, right? Like we're just abreasting those Appalachia. That's where we're at.
So we are unfortunately kind of running out of time here. I feel like we could have talked for another hour. Maybe we'll have to reconnect again, but tell us about, you know, where we can find you. where people can, you know, find your company and if they want to work with you and, you know, pick your brain. You're just, you've been a plethora of information I've learned so much from, and love how generous you are with that. So.
Well, thank you. So you can find me on LinkedIn, of course, Sarah with an H, Badiman. Then you can also find me at HIPAA Trek. That's HIPAA with one P and two A's. So HIPAATREK.com. And all my contact information, how to call me and email me, is all on LinkedIn. I make that public information. And like I said at the very beginning, we don't charge for consultation. So if you have any questions, like, seriously call. I do not have a problem at all answering any questions.
Well, I love your heart. I love your ethos. I think the ethos that we kind of share is going to be a special one. And I think it's going to be the catalyst to allow these cost centers to really elevate to these strategic assets and to help motivate and accelerate the lights turning on at the top. It's going to take us kind of giving to give and leading with value and trying to just help people around us. And, you know, if we plant those good seeds, we're going to get those good crops. So I appreciate your leadership and you willing to be this example. It's very empowering and it's very inspiring.
Oh, thank you so much, Nick. It was such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. So we will see you all soon. Bye-bye.